Mormon Matters Podcast is a production of the Open Stories Foundation and is seeking to build financial support separate from Mormon Stories Podcast. All donations to Mormon Matters are fully tax deductible and go directly towards keeping the podcast alive and towards building a community of support for Mormons like you. To support the podcast or to join the community, please become a monthly subscriber today at mormonmatters.org.
Okay, well, so I want to move to personal faith crisis as it associates with history. But Matt, I think you use the term sacred history as a history that acknowledges that God may be a primary mover. The thing that I think leads to faith crisis, and I think where the mantle is far, far greater than the intellect talk, which was, if I'm not mistaken, that was really given towards CES people, right? Church education system folks. Am I remembering the setting for that talk?
Yeah, and of course, got passed around.
Right.
And then when Mike gave his rebuttal, I think it earned it a lot of publicity.
Right. But he's talking, instead of sacred history, I mean, obviously he is the sacred history of model. God is the primary mover. But It's more the question of how do we present the sacred narrative, which is sort of the Sunday school church educational system that God's in charge, that you know, we're gonna de-emphasize the human foibles, the warts and all, you know, one of those terms that we hear all the time, warts and all history. We're gonna de-emphasize those in favor of the other one. And so faith crisis, I think, for most of us who've at least acknowledged the possibility that there's a God and, you know, maybe felt the influence of God in our own lives, we're all on board with sacred history. But it's when the sacred narrative, the story of the history of the Mormon Church, gets challenged that we're often thrown into faith crisis. And so, Ron, I'm guessing that's what you were going through when you were being confronted with all these different things. But I'd love maybe just to kind of share who talks a little bit more. Maybe we'll ask Ben and then Matt to talk to. When you guys, in your own, either from your perspective as trained historians or just from your own faith journeys, how is it? Because I remember, okay, one more thing, and then I'm really going to ask you the question. Leonard Arrington says, I've seen everything in the archive, and none of it throws me as long as I remember that God always has to work through human beings, right? Isn't that somewhat of a paraphrase of one of his quotes, right? So in other words, there's nothing in there that makes him a non-believer as long as he acknowledges human foibles. How did you guys get to that point? How is it that history as a discipline has alerted you to be able to successfully manage the transition to where this stuff that you're seeing isn't making you atheists or anti-Mormons?
I could take a shot first, and I guess I'll share a personal anecdote to lead up to it. The last month of my mission, which was a lot longer ago than I would like to admit, we had a guest speaker who was a noted scholar of Mormon history. And the speaker came out and gave a presentation on Joseph Smith and gave a question-answer period at the end. And this speaker said, I know that you missionaries are confronted with a lot of these difficult facets of church history, and I want you to know that all of them can be resolved really easily. So don't be afraid to ask the controversial questions that have always been on your mind. And so I asked, I heard someone mention that the temple endowment was stolen from Freemasonry. Is that true? And the speaker, very, very confident in their answer, said, no, Joseph Smith only attended 3 Masonic meetings in his life, and there is no influence whatsoever. And I was like, oh, that's awesome. And I felt very comforted in that response, and I knew that history vindicated all. Well, I got home, and shortly after that, I had the great opportunity to work as a research assistant for the Joseph Smith papers. And one of my first duties was to transcribe the Freemasonry minutes from the Nauvoo period. And I very quickly found out that Joseph Smith attended quite a few more than three Masonic meetings, and was quite common and getting into those. And I found out that it was a lot more messy and a lot more tricky. And I honestly went through a crisis of faith with that. That kind of started a snowball effect. And I was wondering, how am I going to deal with this? And it took a while for me to realize that my main angst with that is because I had a picture set up of what history was supposed to be like, what God's hand was supposed to look like when looking at a historical narrative. And then I was very fortunate to be around people on the Joseph Smith Papers Project who were able to contextualize it. And when I was able to place that historical anomaly within the broader context, it didn't trouble me at all. It was very easy to take a step back and realize that this is one of the great examples of how God can work through our surrounding climate in order to answer questions. That Joseph Smith has these very powerful endowment principles and covenants revealed from God, and he needs a vehicle in which to present them. And this is a very strong example of what you could call horizontal revelation, where you find things around you. And so as a historian, I was soon able to get these tools to realize that the messiness of history doesn't have to be problematic for faith as much as it can be very amenable to it, because it taught me, just like Leonard Arrington said, that there's always going to be foibilities of humans. There was a podcast you did recently here on Mormon Matters with Richard Bushman on patriarchal blessings, where he made a very, very profound statement that one of the key tenets of Mormonism is everything is facilitated through human beings. Human beings will always act as a mediator. And I think that's a powerful theological point, because it teaches you to have to deal with human problems. It forces you to deal with ambivalence. And then in return, it makes things like faith a decision that's positively laden with moral significance, because it makes you having to choose something based on faith rather than history always offering a concrete piece of knowledge.
I love that, and I'm welcoming you to answer this question, but I'm throwing it, Matt, if you want to start your answer on it, that's fine too. But John DeLynn is famous in his podcast for just finally saying, you know, because you've acknowledged all the difficulties and the human foibles and all that stuff, Ben. His whole thing is, what if this just, there's so much of this ambiguity or whatever that it just doesn't pass any kind of basic, he calls it the smell test. You know, that there's just such overwhelming sense of it. Why should I bother? And you seem to, you know, speak affirmatively of this is an important process in anybody's spiritual journey to dive in and stuff. But yet you acknowledge that it's the tools of historian and your immersion. What about for that person who just is barely presented with the difference between the sacred narrative and a few of these wild facts, you know, that says this is a mismatch or something like that? Why should they bother to get to that perspective that Arrington has, that you're talking about, that I think everybody on this group has? So either one of you, Ben or Matt, on that.
Why should they bother?
Especially if they're not historians and they're not forced to it, sort of by the profession.
Sure. Well, I mean, I think we might flatter ourselves by looking at our discipline and saying, well, it's important to be able to think like a historian, because this is not simply about religion. It's about how you function in the world. It's about, you know, constantly being disappointed by setting yourself up to lean on flimsy narratives, be they about your country or be they about the nature of science itself, be they about how human beings really work.
Love it.
You know, and two things. First, they're sort of related. First, related to what Ben was saying before, and getting back, I think, to what I was saying about the nature of sacred history in general, I'm going all the way back to Thomas Aquinas. We have this concept of the proximate cause and the secondary cause. And the proximate cause for Aquinas was saying, well, the proximate cause occurred when God created the universe. That is, God reaches into history and shoves stuff around and makes things happen. And he is the primary cause for these things. But that's not necessarily how most of human history actually works. and for most of human history, God is a secondary cause. That is, God works indirectly. God's will is made manifest indirectly, simply by the nature of the universe itself. Things will tend towards God's ultimate intentions, but that doesn't mean that we should expect to see God pulling the strings every single time. That, I think, is a way in which many contemporary religious historians tend to work. George Marsden, who I referred to earlier, says that his job is talking about these secondary causes, not talking about ultimate causes, even though he believes in them. But we can still understand, we can locate God's will in history, even if it is through these messy and secondary causes. The other way, and that's, I think, a useful way to think about history that might help people to some degree. But the other thing I want to say is that I think much of this argument of, well, here are many reasons why we should think that religion is silly, or why we might think that the church is not true, reasons X, Y, Z, the Crusades, the Old Testament, Joseph Smith's polygamy, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. In many cases, I think these misunderstand fundamentally what religion is about, because they misunderstand what human nature is like. And we've been trained, I think, since the Enlightenment to think of ourselves as being basically rational beings.
Right.
We think in terms of, well, here's arguments why I should stay in the church, here's arguments why I should not. And we try to weigh these each other. We make pro and con lists, right? We try to convince ourselves through rational argument. But that's not really how we work. 90% of the decisions you make in the day are based on things that exist at levels far deeper than your rational consciousness. You cannot rationally explain to me why you prefer Honey Bunches of Oats to Chex Mix. You can't rationally explain to me why you might love your family. These are things that happen on levels far deeper than that. And that's, I think, where religion first happens too. Religion is not about empirical argument. Religion is about how you emotionally engage with the universe. As Terry Eagleton says, the difference between science and religion is whether or not you experience the universe as a gift or not.
I love it.
And I to jump in there on that beautiful points that Matt is making, I think Mormonism presents a very strong theology for this agency, for seeing human beings as a proximate cause for lots of what happens both in the world and within our historical narrative. I think we're equipped through several sections of the Doctrine and Covenants and through the Pearl of Great Price that give human spirits such strong and prominent eternal agency that we're able to handle these types of issues. And so I think that's a way in which a theology can influence how we view history rather than the other way around.
Agree. Awesome. Terrific.
One of the difficulties that we have in trying to help people today who are confronted by stuff that they don't understand and have it reconciled with the faith of their heritage is that for a long time we have equated the legitimacy of this religion with the historical veracity of the early events. And as people have scrutinized those early events, they've drawn conclusions, some pretty boldly, that such and such couldn't have happened, or we've caught him in a lie here, therefore what he says about everything else is gone, and so someone writing a biography prefaces it with the idea that this man is a pious fraud. We've got to, and I still see this in our pulpit rhetoric, that we equate the legitimacy of the church today with the historical antecedents and their legitimacy in the past. And I think what both Matt and Ben have been saying is that religion is something quite different than that, and deserves to be looked at and understood differently than trying to have this equation of empirical evidence applied to the roots of the religion to determine whether or not it's legitimate. And I don't think we've thought through that far enough, nor described the process sufficient that people could find a primer, for example, on how to grow and maintain faith in light of history and historical kinds of questions.
Terrific.
No. What I'd like is to hear what Ben and Matt have to say about what's happening today in the environment of Mormon studies, because my tenure of and career kind of over now, and which is kind of an interesting thing. There are a whole bunch of people that are my age who are soon to check out of the milieu of Mormon studies. And there wasn't a generation right behind us, like who are just 10 years younger than us. It's almost like it went an entire generation, and now we have these remarkable young people, men and women, who have encouraged me enormously that the future of Mormon studies and the future of the study of religion per se are in good hands, and I'm very encouraged. So I'd like to hear what Ben and Matt have to say, and I may not have anything to say at all anymore, but why don't we do that?
Well, I think one of the more interesting things happening now among the generation of people who are in grad school now, who have finished grad school in the last 5 or 6 years, is this real increased interest in what we might call Mormon studies, which is distinct from Mormon history. So much of the work on Mormonism, except for a couple of shining examples, over the past 50 years or so, has been in history. But today you have a lot of people who are really interested in religious studies as a discipline, who are interested in notions like a ritual, who are interested in theology, who are interested in lived religion, who are interested in sociology, anthropology, other ways of understanding what exactly it means to be a Mormon. And that, I think, is going to direct us towards a lot of interesting historical work as historians that we've overlooked. I think we could do with a great deal more work on Mormon worship practices, on the sacrament meeting, for instance. We could do with a great deal more of work, I think, on Mormon popular culture, on things like the works of Nephi Anderson and C.C.A. Christensen, and how these helped to shape what people have understood how to live as Mormons, and how people practice this faith over the past 180 years.
So you're excited for all these multiple disciplines that are doing it, and I guess Mormon studies is seen as a legitimate field the way Jewish studies or feminist studies or, you know, any religious studies type thing is doing it. That's allowing these other scholars to not necessarily specialize in Mormonism, but still make it a legitimate inquiry from their discipline.
Sure. And I think Mormons themselves actually are growing interested in this sort of thing too. And that's actually, I'm glad you brought that up, because that's another important thing, I think, which is occurring now. You know, for so long, we only had one Jan Ships, and now we have more and more and more who are interested outside the church, who are interested in it, who are writing about it and bringing, I think, perspectives and questions that it just does not occur to people raised Mormon to ask.
Yeah, terrific. Please.
And I think a big part of that is that Mormon historians and scholars are now willing to engage with these broader fields, and that's what's bringing these people from outside of the tradition to become interested. I mean, one of the great hallmarks of new Mormon history, the work that was done in the 70s and 80s and 90s, is they started using these outside methodologies. They started using these the context outside of Mormon history to reflect on what Mormon history really was. And I think what you're finding with lots of scholars now is they're saying that Mormon history isn't so much unique or isn't so much that it's interesting for its own sake, but it's interesting because it tells great stories about the surroundings, about the surrounding culture. Joseph Smith isn't only important just to understand the origins of Mormonism as much as he's interesting to understand the role of prophets in antebellum America.
Right.
Or Joseph Fielding Smith is interesting not just to understand Mormonism's retrenchment during the late 20th century, as it is to understand the fundamentalist movement that takes place upon across America in the early and mid 20th century. And I think these conversations are bringing about new audiences that makes it a legit field, even more. So in the past, although we're standing on the shoulders of those who came before, and I think it's a logical progression of the historical community.
Awesome. Ron, as you're listening to these guys, and I know you've got to go in just a few minutes, and maybe we'll go a bit longer without you, did you hear what you wanted to hear? What else would you like them to talk about after you're gone? And just any final closing thoughts from you?
I would just pose a question, I suppose. And that is what Ben and Matt and you, Dan, think that 10 years is going to bring for Mormon studies. What is the ambition right now of academics to in their investigation of Mormonism in light of other religious movements in the United States, if not the world? But where do you see Mormonism going in 10 years?
Cool. And any final we'll take that, and you can stay on the call as long as you want. But anything else, though, besides just questions for us? Is there any last thought that you want to make sure you get in before you have to jump off the call?
I think the drip's done.
Well, we loved having you, so thank you so much. And I know these guys have, behind the scenes, have spoken so well of you, and it's neat for our audience to get to know you, my friend.
Thank you.
Do you guys want to take on Ron's question, either of you? What do you sense is 10 years from now? What will we see? I liked your idea of what is the ambition for academics towards Mormonism from these different disciplines. Any of you guys?
I think a logical progression is the emergence of these Mormon studies in different academic departments. Right now, we have Mormon studies chairs at Utah State and then at Claremont, which has a strong hub of Mormon studies. But there are several more that have been announced that they're raising funding, like Wyoming and the University of Virginia. And I think I heard something about Arizona State, but I'm not sure. And I think the broader the spectrum where you get a decentralized focus on Mormon history brings in new perspectives. So I think we're going to get new people thinking about Mormonism in new ways. We're going to be coming from different approaches. They're going to be looking at different holes in the academic history that haven't been addressed. I think the most glaring holes is we're going to see more done, not just in the disciplines that Matt points out, like worship and liturgy, but just chronologically more done in the 20th century. You're going to see more done in international history. And I
right.
think they're going to be very rich and understand the religious practice of these saints in multiple different environments and different eras and in different cultures.
Okay, cool. Matt?
Yeah, I agree with that. I think the international thing is quite interesting. And we'll, I think, get to something I mentioned briefly before, which is, I think, you know, a long time ago, Ben talked about the social history of Mormonism. And I think we actually need more of that. We need to understand better the story of Mormonism aside from, you know, people in the Quorum of the 12 Apostles and First Presidency, like what it was like to be an everyday Mormon, and what practicing your religion was like if you lived in North Carolina in the 1880s and you were a Mormon. Questions like this, questions away from kind of the traditional centers of power in Mormon history, and towards, ultimately, I think, towards the International Church.
Cool. Yeah. Yeah. In 2005, we hosted Laurie Mathley Kipp, who's at North Carolina, a really terrific scholar and historian. And she presented something that I thought was fascinating. She talked about how we've been so limited to the question. I think she called it the sincerity box.
Yeah.
You know, did Joseph Smith really believe what he was doing? Was he a conscious fraud or this or that and the other thing? And she says, I'm not at all interested in that, you know, as a historian. I want to know, you know, why did the church take hold in certain regions of the country? What was it about its narrative that did this? I want to know about the common person and stuff like that. And so I agree. She's opened that up. And I think for this listening audience, though, we're still so stuck on the question of, is it true? And because if it's not true, I don't know if I want to bother having my life interact with it in this sort of all-encompassing way that Mormonism, you know, it seems it wants to take over your life kind of thing. And so do you guys or any of you have that ability to say, why is the truth false question no longer your primary question? Or maybe it is still, but yet, I don't know.
Yeah.
I'll just let either of you jump off that
one. Two things. The first is, one, you know, that's a question, I think Galari is right to say, that's a question that simply can't be answered historically with the tools that we have in our discipline. It's going to be unresolvable. We could argue about it forever and invent counterfactuals and dig up new data about what some neighbor of Joseph Smith said in the 1820s, and it would not prove ultimately the question one way or the other. It's a question, really, then goes back, and again, I'm going to invoke the classical world, but in a lot of ways, it goes back to Martin Kaler's discussions of Jesus. Kaler is a German theologian in the late 19th century, and he says we have two things. We have the Jesus of history, and we have the Christ of faith.
Right.
And these are two different people, even, almost in a sense. And talking about one does not necessarily mean we talk about the other. Joseph Smith founded a sacramental religion, a religion based on ordinances and practices. And, you know, another thing that St. Augustine had to deal with was the Donatists, who were a group of Christians who were eventually declared heretical in the 5th century, who argued that specifically in their case, that if a Christian priest had renounced his religion under threat of persecution from the Roman Empire, that rendered everything he did null. So any right. baptisms that priest performed were not valid because he had renounced his faith. And ultimately, the Catholic Church, largely led by Augustine, declared that these people were not credible, that they were heretical, and that the power of God enacted in the sacraments that these priests performed was not dependent upon their personal righteousness. And I think, you know, these are some kind of interesting parallels that might offer some, you know, some fuel for this discussion, I think, as we talk about Joseph Smith's own credibility and what relationship that has to his religion.
Good. Please write that article now.
he needs to finish it.
Okay, good. Good. Yeah, that plays out into the whole, you know, if the priest has sex with his girlfriend the night before he blesses the sacrament, you know, that kind of stuff. There's all sorts of levels that works into Mormonism, too.
I think a great example.
I'm checking out.
Oh, man. Sorry, Ron.
Thanks for letting me be with you. Appreciate it very
Thanks.
Much.
Thanks, Ron.
It was awesome. Thank you, brother. Talk to you soon. Go ahead, Ben.
A great article that I think exemplifies these things that we're talking about is in Sunstone last year. Steve Taysom, who's a wonderful scholar,
yes.
Professor of religion at Cleveland State University, wrote an article on the first vision. And he very gently, but I think very profoundly, said we need to move past this question of whether it happened or not, because only one person can tell us that, and he's dead. But we can ask very interesting questions of what has the first vision meant to those of the first generation? What did it mean to Joseph Smith later on in his life? These are questions. I mean, there's only one question of did it happen or not, but there are hundreds of questions that can reveal not only insight into Joseph Smith, but insight into Mormonism in general that I think we sometimes miss when we focus on just that one question. And I think that's an article that can be recommended to the listeners as an example of what we're talking about here.
Yeah, I'll link to it. It was terrific. That was one of my favorites too. Awesome. What else do you guys have on this particular thing? And then I'll just steer us to just a couple of other little loose end areas. Anything else on, you know, truth, false, why it's interesting, if Mormonism isn't the one and only true church, or if these ordinances aren't necessary for salvation, why are you guys still engaged? What is it that just, you know, through these processes of directed focus that grad school, you know, has at least probably made you guys go through it a little bit quicker pace than a lot of people? What is it that you found either through other traditions or Matt, obviously the ancient world often, you know, with you, and what is it that just helps you frame why you stay engaged with a religion that may not be exactly what the sacred narrative has said it is?
I could say something. There is an interesting line that I'm going to butcher, but in Paradise Lost, in which it said that the demons of hell know that God exists, but they don't believe in him.
Hmm.
And I think, you know, that differentiation between faith or belief and empirical knowledge is an interesting one. I tend to think of faith as being more a principle of action than it has anything to do with cognitive knowledge or of something. Faith is a choice of the way in which you're going to live your life. Faith is a choice that indicates the sort of universe that you want to live in. And it has very little to do, I think, in what you think you know or don't know.
And to piggyback off of that, I think that the reason I've remained Mormon is within Mormonism has nothing to do with its history. Davis Bitton wrote an essay a few years ago that I think had a very strong message of truth in it, to where I don't have a testimony of church history. That's right. Not what I base my faith on. I base my faith because I find the theology and the belief of Mormonism engaging and validating, and it gives me a moral prerogative of how to act in this life. I think in this sense that you can never have enough proof, historical or otherwise, of something true, and that's what makes faith a moral decision. As Matt mentioned, it's something that you may not know is true, but it's something you hope is true. And I think that's made out of different faculty, from a different faculty that we do of faith, although it's not inimical to it.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Yeah, I'm with the Bitten sensibility too. The one piece that I always add on to it is I love, besides the theological ideas, which I find huge and, you know, plenty of room for me to play around in, I just love the emphasis of, hey, guess what? Right from the beginning, if any of you lack wisdom, go to God yourself. Joseph Smith constantly, hey, I've had these experiences, go have them yourself. The whole invitation of Mormonism is to, you know, grow and things like that. Of course, Sunday Mormonism, stage 3, you know, orientation Fowler is what we meet in, but always the call and the prerogative is there for those who want to dive in deeper and get a feel. And I don't know, I kind of was asking you guys, when did truth become less important? I know Richard Bushman, when he interviewed with John DeLynn, he said, yeah, goodness is far more important than truth for me. It sounded like you were talking there, Ben, about, you know, dealing with the Davis Bitten quote. How do I orient in the world? How do I, you know, think about the way I act? Is truth, you know, where does truth stack up for you guys compared to the other things that Mormonism brings?
Well, I think that truth has to be possible. I don't think we can ever know of a surety of one way or another, but I think it's within it. But if we're basing these types of questions on what my rational mind says is conclusively true, I don't think I could ever make a decision.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So I think there's a delicate balance there that I think can be made both intellectually and spiritually. And I think that, and for me, it's come about in the last few years to where even when I would go through tough moments while I work for the Josema Papers Project, I feel stronger in my commitment to the church now than I ever have before. Even though my problems with the church are probably more apparent to me than they ever have been before, because of an understanding of how human nature works and how and what lessons history teaches us and what lessons history doesn't teach us. I think it's a tough balance, but I think it can be achieved.
Awesome. Matt, a closing thought in that area?
Yeah, no, I'd agree with that. I think I have a little different path because I have never really wrestled with historical issues in the church. And of course, you know, being in the profession that I'm in, I deal with it a lot and I think about it a lot, but it has never been much of a problem for me because I was inactive from about age 15 or 16 until I started my PhD program.
Really? Okay.
And what renewed my interest in practicing religion was attending the Mormon History Association. And so it has been actually, you know, the Mormonism that I chose to embrace again was, in fact, this gloriously complicated version of Mormonism.
And to build off that and to plagiarize Matt, he had a great line in a recent online column at Peculiar People where he said that, kind of embracing this complicated notion, that there is much that Mormons can believe, but very little that Mormons must believe. And I think that's a vantage point that I think captures my understanding of the nuanced nature of theology, of truth, and of the church.
Hey, you guys, this has been awesome. I was looking over my notes here. You guys have hit on at least every area I want to talk about. I know there'll be plenty of more that our listeners, as they write comments to the blog, will throw up there. But is there anything left on either of your like notepads that you maybe brought with you to the phone or to your computer that you haven't been able to say?
Should we mention a few things about Elder Jensen?
Oh, please, that would be great. Yeah, I mean, that was partly what you and my conversation started this on, was this transition from him and what his openness and his public persona and things have meant to us and stuff like that. Do either of you want to weigh in on that? That'd be great.
I have a few things to weigh in if we talk about that.
I'd love it.
Yeah, go for it.
I think that Elder Jensen, it kind of embodies this approach of being able to balance a very faithful commitment to the church as well as a frank knowledge and acknowledgement of the difficulties of histories. I have a few anecdotes of Elder Jensen that I think catches that. And one is when I was a summer fellow with the Richard Bushman Summer Seminar, it was right when the new church history library had opened. And we got to get a special tour from Rick Turley to go around and see the vaults and the different rooms and the offices. And going up to the top floor where Elder Jensen's office was, we walk in and front and center on Elder Jensen's book was a very recent and very controversial book in church history that I would have never in a million years had imagined would find its way on a desk of a general authority, except for maybe chastising it. I don't know. But I mean, it was sitting on the desk and it had dog ears going off out of the side. It had a pen and a notepad next to it. And it was then that I realized that Elder Jensen isn't an absent church historian. He was one that was really very much involved. And the few times that I've been privileged to have a conversation with him at meetings, he was very much aware of not only church issues, but church historiographical issues. And I think he had a very direct goal during his tenure to bring these issues to the forefront and to be able to deal with them honestly and directly and to deal with them professionally. I think one of the legacies of Elder Jensen will be that say a decade, two decades ago, you go in the church history department, and while they're very professional in their demeanor, you would see most of them have bachelor's degrees, master's degrees, and then lots of great amateur experience in the field. Whereas now when present, and maybe people who had PhDs in history or religious studies, you could probably count on a few fingers. Whereas now that Elder Jensen is leaving his office this summer, they have something like two dozen PhDs that are full-time on the staff at the Church History Library. And that, I think, is phenomenal. And that, I think, they have the ears of the brethren to be able to gently and faithfully correct some of these narratives that have been so problematic in the past, because it shows a commitment to a deep and textualized understanding of the church's history.
Awesome. Matt, anything from your observations of the Jensen era?
I think Jensen's real legacy is his capacity to build bridges between the church history office and academic historians, bridges between the amateur and the professional, bridges between Mormon scholars and non-Mormon scholars as well. And, you know, and I think that has a great deal to do with his intellectual curiosity, his intellectual interest, but it also has to do with his character and just sort of the extraordinary capacity he has for empathy, for sympathy, for understanding this task of doing history as a task of building a community. He really grasps that, and I think he's left the field stronger for it.
And I think he embodies a sense to where when you have a deep and sophisticated understanding of history, it can make you a more committed saint. I mean, when you listen to his talks at General Conference or his devotionals or his when he's on assignment for regional conferences or state conferences, you can just tell he's an individual that knows the problematic nature of human beings. Right. And as a result, he emphasizes to us that we need to be sympathetic, that we need to be empathetic, that we need to be knowledgeable of those on the fringes of culture, fringes on society. And those, I think, are some of the most important lessons we learn from history. And it stands as a testament to a deeper history can make you a better saint and more committed to the right type of ideals of the church.
Awesome. Yeah, I had nothing but positive interactions with him when I was the head of Sunstone. I met with him a time or two, and plus of all, just, you know, seeing him in casual settings at MHA and whatnot. And he was like you say, he was terrific. I think he recognized that Sunstone had its own role, the independent sector of Mormonism. You know, that was one of the bridges that he recognized. It was good that we were doing their thing out there. And at one time when I had a little issue with trying to get some pictures, some historical archive pictures, he gave me his card. He says, "I'm your contact here. If you ever have any trouble again, you know, to help illustrate an article, write to me." And so he was always just full of good humor and compassion with me and really present with me. You know, when we were in a conversation, I knew that he was giving me his attention, not just looking for a way to get out of that conversation and stuff. So I like him too, but I wish Ron was on the call, because just last Friday, he and I were in a conversation where I guess he doesn't know Stephen Snow personally, but I guess it was his son's mission president, and through that and a few other things, he was able to express to us at the little gathering that I was at with Ron that Elder Snow is terrific, that in temperament and stuff, obviously you're going to have a slight difference there, but the people who have shared with Ron, you probably couldn't have picked a better candidate to sort of continue with this good mojo, or whatever we'd want to call that Elder Jensen says. Do either of you have any experience with Elder Snow?
Not me. I just know he seems to have the same type of pedigree as Elder Jensen, which makes me very hopeful.
Matt, anything?
Yeah, he actually spoke in my stake yesterday.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah, and I actually tried to chase him down, but he was whisked out of the building very, very quickly, unfortunately. But yeah, it was an interesting talk, because he was winging it, as I think many general authorities do when they visit stakes.
But it was essentially about inclusion and about the importance of embracing people of all varieties in the church. He spoke at great length about parents with inactive children and seeking to express inclusivity and love towards those children. So that bodes well for me, I suppose.
Neat. Thank you so much. Other things, guys, anything else to share before we come to close?
Just to add to a point that I made a little earlier about Elder Jensen's legacy of leaving these great PhD and professional scholars in the church history department, I think it's very notable to recognize that with that, the LDS Church History Library in Salt Lake has one of the largest gatherings of religious historians with PhDs in one place in Western America.
Oh.
That focus on America's religious history and, in this sense, Mormonism. I mean, you get some faculties at different universities that rival it and surpass it, but I think the fact that they have one of the largest settings where academic historians are on the payroll, I think bodes very well for how seriously we take our approach to our past and a bright glimpse of how we'll deal with it in the future.
Very cool. Well, hey, you guys, I loved this conversation. I was really excited. Bennett took us a few months to get together. I know it was partly because of Matt doing his big book tour and you guys finishing semesters and all that stuff. And Ron is in the middle of planning the big MHA conference up in Alberta, Canada. So it was we finally found a moment to do it here on the middle of early afternoon for most of us. But you're 7 hours ahead of me, Ben, so it's your early evening for you. But thank you so much for this. Listeners, please bring your questions, bring your observations to the MormonMatters.org blog. We'll get some things going there. I'll invite Matt and Ben and Ron to engage you there, especially if I don't see them answering something that you might have proposed to one of them right away. But I'm excited for that. But continue to support Mormon Matters. We love doing this. It's a privilege. I know we're making a difference in people's lives, and if you can support that financially, please, please do. That really helps things around my house. But anyway, mostly I'm just grateful for good hearts, articulate voices, great minds. You guys have been just wonderful guests, and I'm so glad our audience got exposed to you. So thank you for being on.
Thank you, Dan.
All right. Wish you guys a good day.
Thanks.
Thanks.
Cue the music.
Thank you for joining us today on Mormon Matters Podcast. To discuss this podcast with others, please check us out at mormonmatters.org. To keep this podcast alive, or to join our support community, please consider a tax-deductible donation today at mormonmatters.org. Music for this podcast was brought to you by Brittany and Clayton Pixton. The Mormon Matters logo was generously provided by StudioCase.com. Thank you for listening.
Enjoy.